Hello, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, there's a huge one. The legend, Margaret Cho, is on the show today. Stand-up comedy legend, screen legend, and punk rocker. We'll get to more on that in one second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, buddy, for all the hard work you do on this show. I love you so much. And this one took like a year and a half to come together. So thanks for putting in the work, buddy. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm on various forms of social media at Left4Damian. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling all your friends about it or subscribing to it and rating it on your platform of choice or picking up a t-shirt for this podcast at turnedoutofpunk.com. Thank you. Thank you to people that have done that. It is very much appreciated and helps keep the lights on around here. I play in a band. We're called Fucked Up. We will be going on tour starting this weekend, actually, in Texas. We got some dates in Colorado, or a date in Colorado, in New Mexico, in Arizona. Check fuckedup.cc for more information about the band and these upcoming tour dates. And on to today's show. As I said off the top, on the show today, we have a legend in the house, Margaret Cho. If there's a stand-up comedy Hall of Fame, she would be in there. She's also known for countless TV roles, her own TV series, a groundbreaking actor and comedian, and a legend. There's no other way to put it. Tristan, as I said, has been working on this happening for a very long time, and we are so grateful that it has finally happened, because years ago, I had heard that Margaret Cho was into punk. And actually talking to Chris O'Toole, shout out to Chris O'Toole, co-host of Footnotes and Turned Out of Punk God around here. Anyway, I was talking to Chris O'Toole, and he brought up a whole bunch of stuff involving Margaret Cho and punk rock things and punk rock adjacent things. So, yeah, we're all very excited about this one around Turned Out of Punk. I'm not going to ramble on. I don't think there's anything else for me to bore you with right now. Margaret Cho will be going on tour throughout the fall. You can find out more information about her tour dates at margaretcho.com. And go and see her live, because this is someone who still hilarious, unbelievably funny, unbelievably incredible. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Margaret Cho on Turned Out a Punk. Margaret, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course. Thank you.
Well, as I told you off air, this is a big one for me because I'm a huge fan of yours. And also, we have mutual friends in the greatest rhythm section of all time, Jason Udarsi and John Worster.
Oh, they're my bands. I'm in a band with them. I'm not sure what the band is called. Maybe it's Chos Before Bros. It might be. They're awesome. I've actually sung with them with Bob Mould's, doing Bob Mould songbook and stuff with Bob Mould, and work with them many times. And I really, really love them.
Well, that's actually another thing we have in common. We've both shared stage with Bob Mould.
Yes.
And it's a privilege for me to get to have done that, as it is a privilege to talk to you. And I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Margaret, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Well, the first time that I ever came across the genre was probably in the early 80s, going to the Rock Against Reagan shows, which also were Rock Against Racism shows, which would feature bands like the Dead Kennedys and Black Flag, and probably Husker Du was in there somewhere, I'm sure. MDC, all these really old school punk rock bands in San Francisco who were playing at the MAB, which I was too young to get into, but I really loved punk as another avenue to understand rock and roll and style and rebellion. And so punk rock to me was super exciting and probably the first music movement that I really felt like I could belong to.
What like drew you to those shows? Because those are kind of, you know, legendary punk shows in San Francisco. But like, what was it about those events? Were you hearing about the stuff in the media prior to it? Or what was it like specifically that brought you out to those?
I think what I heard about were just like things. They were the things that people I knew were going to. They were just the things that I was hearing about. They were also the shows that I didn't have to be 18 or 21 to get in. They were happening during the day. They were happening outside. They were free. That's actually probably the biggest motivating factor. It's just like rock and roll shows that were free, that were happening in the park or down by sort of like a, I guess it would be sort of like fishing docks in San Francisco. Down south of Market down there. But mostly the motivating factor were you weren't paying to get in. And then also like when I was a little bit older, I was going to Barrington Hall, which was in Berkeley. And it was a dorm kind of, and it was sort of a cross between like a dorm and maybe a kind of a co-op living situation. It wasn't a frat house, but it occupied a large building that maybe could have been perceived as a frat house, but really wasn't. It was a sort of anarchist, punk rock, group living situation with lots of very, very smart kids who were doing a lot of drugs, doing a lot of punk shows, and it was really, really rock and roll.
Well, it's kind of fascinating because like I think throughout the 80s, punk, you know, really centralizes in the Bay Area, like San Francisco. It becomes kind of like punk capital. And going into the 90s and the punk rock boom that happens there, it really kind of is centered out of that scene. Like what kind of bands were playing at Barrington Hall? Was it still sort of like MDC and Crucifix kind of era? Or is it like a newer wave of bands?
It was like all sorts of very, I think, you know, names of bands I don't remember at all, like bands that maybe just were sort of like there for the night. There was also like a little bit of a mix of like early electronica. So you had like a bit of rave in there. You had a little bit of variety acts, a little bit of a sort of a Jim Rose circus vibe where you had kind of people who were basically doing self-harm. It's just like really like very punk rock. So I remember at some point like maybe going making plans to go see a Gigi Allen show, but for some reason not being able to go at the last minute or something. But I was peripherally aware of Chicken John and some of the people around, I guess like Murder Junkies people around, but I never, I didn't get to see Gigi Allen. I mean, that was a little bit later in the late 80s, early 90s. So, yeah.
You're probably better for making that choice.
I know. I didn't, it wasn't until later seeing the documentary Hated. And then much later, actually recently, I was in a wing of the Museum of Death and somebody tried to steal one of the artworks of Gigi Allen. I think it was something that he had done. And so it was like an original Gigi Allen, like line drawing. And she had taken it off of the wall and shoved it down in her pants and tried to run out. And I ran out after her and I told the proprietor, she's stealing. And he ran out after and he got it. And for that, I am awarded lifetime free membership or free entry into the Museum of Death until I become an exhibit, I guess.
That's amazing. I kind of collect G.G. Allen stories on this podcast, and that is a G.G. Allen story in absentia. That is amazing.
It's amazing. I mean, it was really bold that she did. And then that sort of, like, I think inspired that museum to really up their security. So now they have quite an array of, like, cameras and everything to make sure that something like that doesn't happen again. But, you know, I guess they just wouldn't think that something like that would be really valuable, but actually very, very, very valuable. So I'm glad that that was not lost.
Well, it's funny because, like, Gigi and John Wayne Gacy used to trade artwork with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a, I guess, a very weird, illicit, artistic marriage in a way.
There was something also, it was very punk to have a Gigi Allen painting. And I know that, you know, now you look at that stuff and you think, well, it's kind of like a horrible thing. And more likely, you weren't getting an original because I think John Wayne Gacy was pretty much running like a little bit of a factory. And some of the you know, people in a prison with him were actually painting these paintings and he would just sign them. So, you know.
There was a book that came out at one point of, I guess, allegedly, all the people that own G.G. Allen paintings, or sorry, John Wayne Gacy paintings, and Oprah Winfrey apparently owned a
interesting a painting.
Yeah, which makes sense, Chicago.
I mean, you know, I guess so. I think that much more valuable to have a G.G. Allen painting. I mean, much more valuable to have any kind of G.G. Allen anything. He's one of those artists that really, that's truly punk. You know, when you're really punk, you don't even make it to the show. Like, you know, when you're really punk, it gets shut down. Most of his shows, I think, would maybe last about 7 or 8 minutes, if that.
Still this day, the most extreme artist of all time in music.
I really think so. I mean, I really regret not getting to see him, but I'm sure that, I mean, I've heard enough about it. I know enough about that kind of stuff. And now being such a germaphobe as the sort of current state of the world is, enforcing us all sort of to be, I couldn't imagine it now.
Yeah. I think it's one of those people that you're grateful, maybe not grateful exists, but you know,
I love, for him. You know, and also that he, was not part of the NEA4, if you remember the National Endowments of the Arts, and they were, people really were coming after the artists in that, and one of them was Karen Finley, and part of her show is she was shoving yams up her ass, and I saw a show of hers, and she didn't shove any yams, there was no yam content, but it was a really great show. She's a really great artist.
I think that's the interesting thing that starts happening too in punk rock, is that you do have that bleed over of performance art and and punk. And I think also in, you know, and I don't know very much about it, this is much more your world than mine, but like certainly in the world of comedy, you start seeing that too, where you have a lot of comedians begin pushing boundaries and start presenting comedy completely differently. And I think that it's amazing how many of these people, from Bobcat Goldthwait to yourself, kind of come out of punk rock or were in punk bands at some point.
Well, Bobcat is like such a punk comic. Like he's like that sort of, you know, on the verge of like between rock star and comedian. You know, there was a time where he was like playing stadiums and his, appearance was like so much about this very it's a very unique, very singular artist, a very punk rock and very much like, you know, this, I really admire him. But I think at my time in San Francisco and going to shows, I think like the most punk comic was probably David Cross, who was always taking us to shows. There was always a drummer of some band staying at his house. There was always some drummer. So there's always some band, but he was really, he was sort of the male, and then the female would be Janine Garofalo. She was like the most punk rock of the women. But yeah, they're my heroes.
Have you ever seen that David Cross clip where it's RuPaul and the U-Hauls playing their first show? And yeah. Have you seen that? And David Cross leans in to light the guitar player's cigarette at some point.
so cool.
It's awesome.
It's so cool because, yeah, RuPaul was all part of that entire, I mean, RuPaul's actually very punk rock as well. So it's all part of, it's all tied in to early punk rock stuff, early like New York stuff. It's really exciting.
Well, there's an energy that just draws all the weirdos to it. Yeah. And it seems to do it perpetually over time. Like you look at new bands that are happening now that are still cool and still interesting kids being drawn to this thing.
Yes. And what I think punk rock is really great about is that it really it really blurs the lines between race and gender and age and sexuality, all of the stuff. It's like if you're punk rock, it sort of makes you already progressive. It makes you already cool. It makes you already cool with others who don't fit in. And so I think that's why it really endures.
I've heard you talk about them and I got to bring them up because they're one of my favorite bands. But what about the Red Rockers? Did you ever see them?
I don't know if I, oh gosh, you know, I love their music and I love the song China like so much. I love the Red Rockers. They're very 415 San Francisco band. So great. Yeah, Cyndi Lauper and I would geek out about Red Rockers all the time. I mean, they're so great. Like, bands like Translator, all of these like amazing kind of West Coast early 80s, late 70s bands like Romeo Void. They're so the sound of my childhood, really, or the Uptones when you get into ska territory. I actually just got an Uptones record and I just can't believe how enduring those kinds of ska records are. They're so good.
Yeah, there's also just on that label, 415 or 415 record, like there's just so many great bands on there. And it's kind of like, I don't know, it's verging on new wave, but it's still like, you know, especially with the Red Rockers, like power pop kind of punk edge.
Yeah. Power pop is really, I think if I were to settle on a genre, it's really power pop because it's a very, it's a very specific genre. Like it's just really, there's only like one band in every scene that would qualify. It's the one that kind of the sounds the most like the Posies. Like it's very specific of a genre. And it's like so meticulous to get into the genre. It's really hard. It's not everybody fits in the genre. It's like a very, a very specific thing. So that I do love power pop. It's all about the 3 o'clock. I love the Paisley underground. I love a jellyfish moment.
Absolutely.
Very into it.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, it's funny because like like Steve and Jeff McDonald were just on the show a couple weeks ago, and I brought up the Paisley Underground, and Jeff seemed to imply that it was completely his creation that he kind of stumbled upon.
I believe it. I think those guys are genius. I mean, I went to a lot of Red Cross shows. I lived with Jerry Finelli, who was their keyboard player for a long time, and so we were privy to so much because of Red Cross. And like Red Cross's advices were like, oh, if you ever want to meet a rock star, just put their name to thank them in the liner notes and you'll meet them. It's like a spell. I think that like Steve and Jeff are like witches. I think that they're like really genius. And I really love them a lot. And then I sort of connect with them too through Frightwig as well. And Frightwig were very important San Francisco band. Also, I think Frightwig is probably the reason why I got into punk rock, because Paula Fraser from Frightwig was like working for my dad in the bookstore that he owned, the gay bookstore that he owned in the 70s. And so she was always telling me about bands that I should see or bands that I should like. She was playing these psychic TV like cassette tapes. So that's probably what got me really into punk rock.
That's awesome. Frightwig was a band that I only really discovered by doing this show. Like they're a band that I don't think gets brought up a lot, but they're certainly a band that had massive impact at the time.
And they still play. And I think that, they're really, really special, really important. And just so punk rock, you know, I think they're just one of those bands that, and they play a lot with Red Cross. So it's one of those bands that should always have a place in all these like conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, it just also speaks to how much great stuff was coming out of San Francisco at the time. Like, what about the Melvins or Neurosis? Did you ever see them?
I don't think I ever saw them, but I'm sure that they were part of the landscape. I mean, there's the Residents, mm-hmm. which were almost a little bit, they almost were like predecessors in a way, like the Residents were almost kind of like elder statesmen of that kind of weirdo aesthetic. And brought the orchestral vibe to the punk rock. Then you had the Tubes, who I absolutely love still. The Tubes are really like, to me, also power pop, very specific, but also kind of like prog rock as well. So they're really, really special.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the Residents because I never really think about it, you know, like that. But they are really the genesis of that kind of weird streak that runs throughout music in the Bay Area and rock and roll. And I think you're right. It really goes back to the Residents all the way up to Faith No More.
Yes. Faith No More and the Residents, Faith No More is incredible. I mean, what an incredible band and also very queer coded, you know, like the Residents also have kind of a queer coded thing. They have kind of a, like an alignment with like the Cockettes, and they have a some sort of like a direct, I don't know, like if you have an eyeball with a cane, there's something about that lends itself to drag. So I love all of that.
Yeah, no, and I think they do have something that's sort of I don't know, very theatrical about the presentation too, the whole way through with that band, like right down to the mystery of who they are, like the fact that they have these double lives.
And like we don't know. Yeah, we don't know who they are. There's like a mystery of the costuming and the grandeur, but it's also surreal and kind of like there's a horror element, but it's not necessarily goth. It's mm-hmm. more psychedelic.
So it's not Penn and Teller, right? You can confirm that?
No, I mean, Penn and Teller is cool too, but Penn and Teller is almost like its own thing. I mean, they were like kind like I would say it's almost closer to something like Banksy. Like, yeah, who is this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, we don't even know who this is.
The rumor was that it was Penn and Teller, and I was going to be like, wow, that would be a real shock. That would be the ultimate twist on that.
But I think you would know because Penn is so tall.
Yeah, that would be a giveaway. There'd be a large football player all of a sudden in the Residents, and you'd be like, wait, something's up. Something's not right.
So, you know, it's hard to know. It's hard to know, but I love all that stuff.
What about The Farm? I've heard you talk about that. Did you go to shows there much?
I went to shows at The Farm. The Farm had the most dangerous pit. Mm. So, because you had them wearing the biggest steel toe boots that were covered in like goat shit and cow shit. Like it wasn't just the regular sort of like Hate Street dog shit and human shit. You had a farm animal, legit farm animal dung on huge, heavy cow boots and like, not boot cowboy boots, but like steel toe punk rock boots and just kicking, like scary kicking. Like, I don't know what was going on, but to me, that was the most destructive pit. Some pits are, you know, the pit is always a very dangerous place anyway. And it got more and more combative and dangerous. Like the longer I stayed in the pit, like I almost died at a Pulp show in the pit during Common People. So I'm like really worried about, because everybody was trying to get the driver's Concord. They were pushing and I almost lost consciousness. My feet were off the ground, but the pit, the more new metal it became, the pit, it was the Junko jeans and like all of the big pants and with the wallet chains were like flying around. You could like knock a tooth out easily.
Oh, absolutely. It's like a mace coming at you, that wallet.
The wallet chain, it is a mace. It's like a medieval weapon. It's like really scary, but with the big pants, and it was really, really a nightmare.
I think it's also the bigger those shows are, the more dangerous those pits can be. Like if it's a small house show, it doesn't matter how violent that pit is because you got to look everyone in the eye. It's when it gets en masse like Pulp playing Common People that you got to start worrying about the sway of the humanity.
I mean, you don't think it's going to be violent when it's Jarvis Cocker, and it may not have necessarily, like, nobody there was sort of thinking that it was going to be, but I think that it was just because they just love Jarvis Cocker so much and they love that song. And it was the, all of the pressure of people lurching towards the stage, like leaning in, and we sort of didn't expect it.
I'd be lurching. I'm not going to lie. I'd be lurching. It's Jarvis.
I was right there. I know. I was right there. So I know.
They were a punk band too, though, Pulp. They started back in 84 doing punk records. So once again, it all comes back.
It does all come back. But, you know, punk rock really thrives where it's cold outside and you have to go inside and do something. And, you know, it's sort of like that. That's where punk bands start, I think, when it's cold.
Did you at one point sing in the White Trash Debutantes?
Yes. That was my first band that I was in, and Ginger Coyote, who is such an incredible sort of like I mean, incredible figure, but also an incredible like rock, like pioneer. She's really astounding. So yes, I was in that band. You know, they would do a lot of glam rock covers. So you had a lot of like Slade covers, a lot of like that kind of stuff. I think it was really, there's a lot of people in the band too. We do shows at the Sixth Street Rendezvous in San Francisco.
Yeah, it's a venerable who's who that was in that band. Billy Gould was in that band from Faith mm-hmm. No More, and mm-hmm. Jimmy Crucifix from Crucifix.
That's right. A lot of people.
Yeah. Like, did you make it to any of the records, or had you already moved to LA by the time they put out the album?
I wasn't on any of the records. I just did the live shows and I only did a few of those. I was just so, I had the huge pink wig and I was so hot inside of everything that I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand all the costuming, but I really love Ginger, and I still speak to her today on occasion on social media. She's really special.
Yeah. A legend. Definitely, yes, a legendary band. Mm-hmm. I got to ask you about a legendary show from where I'm from, Degrassi Junior High.
Oh, yes.
Talk about that show. Where'd you see that?
You love you and Mike Park. Some of the ska, East Bay ska, really attached to Degrassi Junior High. Like, they really attach to Degrassi and won't let go. It's got a chokehold on the East Bay punk rock ska scene.
Also the Western Mass scene, because Jay Maskus is the biggest fan of Degrassi of anyone I've ever met. That guy's obsessed.
Which, you know, it's so funny because it's like you would never think that. Like, we think of like Dinosaur Jr. as being like so, there's something so emotive about the music and the lyrics that you would never think that somebody that would create that sound would also really vibe with Degrassi. But there's something about Degrassi Junior High. I think there's something like very earnest about Degrassi, and it was very progressive, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like definitely way before its time. Like, it really hit a lot of people in the right way.
And they cast real kids, like Spike from Degrassi was on the show, and she's a legit punk. Like, they cast her as a punk rocker because that's what they were looking for. And who knew that all those Dinosaur Jr. songs were written about her?
It's so cool. I love it. And I think it's really beautiful. I mean, I think it's very, I think it speaks volumes to the honesty and authenticity that Degrassi was like really putting out there, which I think is really beautiful.
Yeah. I think it's one of those shows that it's kind of timeless in the way, because it is so real, and it pre-foretells what kids are into now, right? Like, kids want reality. No one's looking for the polish in the same way they used to. Like, now they want, mm-hmm. you know, very uncharismatic kids talking right into camera, playing Minecraft.
And they do love the perfect imperfect or the unreliable narrators, which I think is what's really, what Degrassi was really kind of like. The predecessor to all the things like Euphoria now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Drake. It gave Drake.
Right. In the new, when they went to the new, like the Y2K version.
Yes. But the Y2K one had some of the old teachers, or some of the old students there now as teachers and mm-hmm. parents and stuff. So it really did feel like the continuity was still there at that point.
Right, because it's still a school. It's still the same school. So I love that.
It's like Coronation Street, but for Canadian kids.
Corey, right. It's Corey. It's Neighbours. It's EastEnders. I don't know if you ever watched EastEnders. It's that British
yes. kind
of working class soap opera, which I loved in the 90s too.
Growing up in Canada, we got a lot of British TV.
Oh.
It was a...
EastEnders was great because it was all about like the fallout after the Falklands War. And the guys coming home and kind of not really being able to deal with their PTSD and their toxic masculinity that they had sort of had to like use to survive, like Phil. I love that show.
I think it's also like that's that, I guess, British kitchen sink drama.
Yeah.
Film stuff on TV. Like they do love kind of like, well, I guess that's where reality TV hit there first.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also, yeah, the realism, it's like, you know, the romance of the working class. There's so many great films, you know, like Billy Liar and The Loneliest and the Longest Distance Runner and, you know, even Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. You know, there's a lot of like really very hyper real emotional movies where not that much happens, but so much happens in terms of like the character's development and what they're feeling. And so, yeah, I love that. I love that stuff.
Yeah. It's I guess that's where Degrassi is kind of like the Training Wheels version of that sort of reality for kids, kind of giving it to them and, you know, 90210 and all these shows try and do it, but it's not, I don't know. It's not the same. I guess that's where Canada kind of gets it right. Rarely do we get it right in terms of TV and movies up here. So,
well, Canada gets it right a lot of the time. I mean, I always thought that SCTV was superior okay. to yeah. SNL. So, and then Kids in the Hall is like superior to any 90s comedy troupe. You know, there's like a lot of like Canadian comedy that really, it prevails. Like it definitely, it outshines any other country. Particularly sketch comedy, I think outshines any other country.
Yeah, we've got some good sketch comedy, but my gosh, there's some rough dramas that you have to watch in Canadian film studies. because I do love the movies as well. I got to ask you about working with John Woo. What was it like working with him?
Incredible. So when my first one of my first days of shooting, we exploded a Cessna. They exploded a plane. And I mean, the 90s, the action films in the 90s, the money, you cannot believe how much money they had. They had 13 separate camera units going to explode this plane. Like it's like you were gonna like have like 13 separate crews, 13 separate like basically not just angles, like entire units to capture this one stunt. And to make the film, like you had to be basically in production for a whole year because there were so many stunt sequences. And John Travolta only worked 10 hours a day. And that was flying his plane. That included flying his plane, getting up, flying his plane to work, and then flying his plane back. So he was commuting from Santa Barbara to Los Angeles every day, and he would fly himself to set and then fly himself home. And he had to leave home and come home in 10 hours. So it took over a year to make the film because he's in pretty much every scene. So it was the amount of money was incredible. But John Woo and I became friends from that. And he brought me to San Francisco for a big thing that he was being honored by. And Chow Yun-Fat was there. And Michelle Yeoh
was there. That's awesome.
Which is like so incredible. And I would try to talk to them about Wong Kar-wai. And they would be like, Wong Kar-wai, that's music. That's music movies. It's music videos. And you know they didn't see film in the same way. But, you know, obviously because they have such very different points of view when it comes to like, I mean, I think Wong Kar-wai is much more of like the, it's like Godard or Truffaut. It's like definitely like a different sort of French New Wave experience. Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, somebody like John Woo is like out of like Clouseau, or like Melville. Like it's a very specific, it's Hitchcock. Like it's a very specific kind of tightly wound cinema that it's not about sort of evocative mood. It's really about like what's happening to break this tension that he's constantly like renewing. And but that movie was so incredible to make because they just don't make them like that. Nobody makes action films like that anymore because we didn't have the advent of like CGI. We actually had to do stunts in like real time, like really big ones.
Well, also like, you know, like John Woo being sort of the greatest artist in that milieu is given the biggest budget ever to make his greatest film. Like, it's kind of like you're there painting the Sistine Chapel kind of vibe with that film. It feels like, well, as someone watching it as a fan.
Yeah, everybody's in it. Like it's like got Joan Allen and Gina Gershon and Doves.
And it's going with that, the Doves.
And Nicolas Cage. And Tommy Flanagan. And all these like great, I mean, just great, great people are in that. But it's like Nicolas Cage is so intense in it because he is half of it, he's John Travolta. So it's like the weirdest thing because he's also a very method actor. So he's in character for half of it. So half of it, he's like really mean. And the other half, he's like John Travolta's character. So he's Castor or Pollux. It's very interesting to work with him.
But like he'd be playing John Travolta's character, not John Travolta when he's doing John Travolta camera.
So he would be either Castor or Pollux in the movie. So it's like a very, it was really interesting because it was like probably like, no, everybody who works with Nicolas Cage has sort of that idea like, oh, he's going to be in this character the whole film. But here he's two different characters. Very, very interesting.
You could write a book just about making this movie.
I probably should. I mean, I think I got to become friends with John Travolta. And so I would sit with him. And one time I saw him eat an entire boysenberry pie with a fork. Like he didn't even cut it. 9-inch pie. Didn't cut it into slices. Just went at it, the whole pie with a fork and ate it. Which I respect. And this was after we had split a beef Wellington. So I admire him so much. And he is like the most king-like person I've ever met, like very much royalty.
Dave from Sum 41 said that when they were recording with Iggy Pop, he ate an entire chocolate cake by himself. So I guess there's something to it, you know?
I mean, I think that, yeah, it's really, I mean, that's inspiring. I think that it's really, I don't see it like in Iggy Pop. Maybe Iggy Pop is so, he's so cut. Like he's so that wiry, muscly fit.
Yeah.
Very like I don't know where he puts it.
Dave asked him. Dave's like, how do you do this? And he goes, I do a lot of deep breathing. And apparently that's how he does it.
Oh, that's so cute.
I think as you're inhaling the cake, like, ooh, and this chocolate cake all over your face.
I guess he's dancing all the time, so I guess he's gonna burn it off. That's great.
When we, the band I play in opened for him, and the story he told us was he doesn't eat at all the day of the show, and then they keep a restaurant open for him all night so he can just gorge himself all night on food.
Oh, great. Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, so I think that's wonderful.
Everyone needs a system, you know?
So rock and roll. I still haven't figured out my system. Like, I never know when to eat. And then by the end of the night, I'm just like, all I have is Sour Patch Kids.
If I eat before the show, it's going to be Gigi Allen. It's going to be a lot of, you know,
I mean, I don't know when to eat. Like, it's really hard to figure that out. And I still haven't really mastered it.
I'm sure a restaurant would stay open for you. You get a restaurant.
I've had that happen, but I think, I also kind of don't know. I just don't never think ahead that far. To do that, I should do that.
When you get up to LA, were you going to shows or are you focused more on comedy at that point?
I was definitely going to shows and then going to lots of festivals, like going to Bonnaroo's. I did a show with GWAR, one of the my highlights, I think, for like my rock and roll life is like doing a show with Gwar and getting in their tent backstage. It smells heavily of Altoids because they're in the huge costumes and they're so hot inside that they have to eat mints in order to feel cool. Mm. And because no amount of air conditioning is going to be enough. So they're constantly eating and chewing a mint. So which is very disconcerting because you think that they're going to smell like, I don't know, blood or whatever, but they really smell like cinnamon and mint.
It's you know, it's funny with that band, the amount of work that went into that and just seeing them. Like that was a band I only got to meet them one time, and I met Dave and he was in character. So I never really got to even meet Dave. I hung out with him in character for the afternoon, but it was, I feel like rest in peace, obviously, but he is someone that I've been fascinated by for a long time. Like what an interesting person.
So interesting. And just gone too young, you know, and what a great band, and just so genius and so different and so innovative and really, really, really special.
Yeah, a band that it just feels like, you know, couldn't happen now, maybe in the same sort of way, because it would be just subsumed by the industry too quickly.
I think so. I mean, they endured for as long as they did. It was like really amazing. And I think that just, you know, people were just really loving them so much. So I really admire their journey.
I've lost the name of it now, but there's apparently a Christian Gwar that I've learned about on the show.
Oh, really? Yes. I didn't know that. Well, I mean, they can do, I guess they'll do a Hamilton. If they're going to do a Hamilton, I guess they might as well do a heavy metal. I don't know. That's weird. But there is Christian rock, so there must be Christian heavy metal.
There is definitely Christian heavy metal, and there's definitely like a parallel Christian punk scene that kind of, you know, happens, springs up around the 80s and goes throughout the 90s. It becomes huge in the 90s. But but there's apparently within this scene a Christian Gwar, which I...
I mean, are they biblical characters? Like, are they like David and Goliath? Like, is it like the monsters from the Bible? Or
I will look it up and find a way to send you the links to. I've watched a couple YouTube videos. It's definitely a lot lower budget than Gwar.
Yeah, and I mean, it would work if it was like biblically accurate angels fighting with like the beast in Revelations. That would be kind of interesting.
That'd be awesome. I mean, yeah.
That would make it like, oh, that's actually kind of cool. Like if you actually did it with like a lot of like VR or whatever, you know, that would be something to see. But I think that's where, is there like black metal, Christian black metal?
There is. Yeah, there's definitely Christian black metal. There's actually even weirder, you know, the band White House, the industrial power noise band from the 80s, the infamous White House. Mm-hmm. There is apparently a Christian anti-White House called Black House that is a Christian answer to White House.
Wow, that's really that's really wow. So I guess there would be like a Christian Death in June then, probably.
I guess so. I guess what it would be called, like Birth in December.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good, yeah, that's what it should be. I mean, that there's just got to be like some sort of answer to everything, but that's kind of incredible.
I think that's, you know, I think that's the thing that there's like, you know, is that rule, whatever that rule about there's a porn version of something on the internet as soon as something exists. Right. There's a Christian rock version of something as soon as
there's got to be. There's got to be. I mean, I don't think I know really any. I mean, there's Christian music that I do like I love the Staple Singers, and I mean, I love like some of the choral music of like Mahalia Jackson, and I do love gospel, and I do, yeah, there's things like that I do like spiritual music that I do vibe with. Like Judy Sill did a lot of like music that was very, she's like sort of folk Christian. But I don't understand like the big like Hillsong kind of music. I like that kind of freaks me out when it gets real corporate.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Like I, you know, as a younger kid that was like very anti-Christian punk from a distance, was, I looked at it as being something that was going to be a recruitment tool that was trying to draw people in. But now, once again, from doing this podcast and meeting a lot of kids that kind of came out of that scene or came up through that scene, it was for them an escape because mm-hmm. their parents wouldn't let them listen to secular music. And they could be like, no, this is a punk song about Jesus. And then the parents would be fine with it. So that was kind of their on-ramp to getting into outside cultures.
That's interesting. I mean, ultimately, Jesus is, if you take Jesus alone, if you actually like a biblical form of Jesus himself is kind of punk rock, where he's like, you know, throwing over like people like trying to lend money in the church and trying to, you know, sort of make money off the church and stuff. So there's something that's kind of very punk rock about that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's actually, well, there's that Jello Biafra DOA song, Jesus Was a Terrorist, I think is the name of it. Mm-hmm. And it's very much about how there's this guy who's anti-state and like you're saying, trying to throw all of these conventions, but I don't know if it's necessarily taken up in the same sort of way in a lot of the Christian punk music.
I don't know, but yeah, I mean, I'm glad that they have an outlet and punk can be for everyone, but that kind of freaks me out.
It is definitely, it's fascinating because it is like, as I say, a parallel world. Like once again, there's some extremes. Like I couldn't imagine the Christian kid that heard White House and was like, okay, I gotta make a response to this record. Mm-hmm. It's like, why were you hearing it in the first place? Like you just avoid it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I just like remember like Stryper, where that heavy metal sort of glam metal Christian band, and they always had this Bible verse number in their like merch, and it's just like that's so weird.
It's like in an Out Burger where it's got the Bible quote on the bottom.
Oh, right, or like a Forever 21. It's got like a John 3:16.
Really?
It's so weird. It's like, what? Oh, no.
Maybe they're just fans of wrestling, and it's a reference to Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Maybe. I hope so. So weird.
That'd be very weird if it was. Either way, it's kind of weird for Forever 21 to do that, you know.
Yeah, it's very strange. I don't know.
I got to ask you about Research Magazine. Were you a fan of that, or were you aware of that back then?
Yes. My parents sold Research Magazine.
Wow, that's awesome.
And they would also sell Tattoo Time because all of my parents' employees were heavily tattooed by Ed Hardy and Bill Salmon, who had a studio a couple blocks away from the bookstore. And so Ed was actually bringing in the Tattoo Time to sell it on consignment. And so I knew Ed since I was a real little kid, but so we had Research, and Research was like such an incredible publication. I mean, just all of their issues were just so amazing.
Mm-hmm. And then the books, when they got into doing the books about, you know, mm-hmm. zines and then, you know, anarcho-syndicalism. They had so many different interesting books that I was like picking up on as a kid.
So many interesting books. Like they had their Modern Primitives was probably mm-hmm. the most progressively like interesting and wild, like where people were getting very heavily pierced and tattooed, and the Fakir Musafar had like a lot of stuff in there where he was like doing the corset training and all sorts of stuff, you know, that there's just like wild stuff in that.
And I think that's the thing about the distribution of those books, especially when you had big box bookstores eventually carrying this stuff, is the hands they got into were really, it would have been people that would not have seen it in the Midwest or mm-hmm. I say that middle of Canada too, and stuff like that. Like, I think this was a great beacon at a certain point for people.
Oh yeah. And it was also just a way to kind of like make these sort of things so accessible. So you could sort of learn about them in a way that wasn't just lurid and you know, very like a cautionary tale. It was actually just people who were in it and wanted to explain what they were doing in it, which I think is really cool.
So did your parents' bookstore carry other zines too?
Yeah, we carried a lot of a huge amount of porn, which now is like really incredible to me. Like also Skin 2, all of those like latex magazines from England. We had a lot of gay like bodybuilding publications, and then leaning into things like Honcho and Blue Boy, which is sort of like men's magazines. So there was a lot of like that kind of stuff, you know, instead of say like Playboy and Penthouse, we had all of the gay ones. The only heterosexual like female nudity we probably ever had was like Madonna's sex book. But other than that was like very, very gay oriented.
Well, definitely it seems more like transgressive and subversive kind of literature too.
Yes.
In that kind of world, which it feels like it feels like that's such like a, I don't know, that's something that's kind of lost now. I feel like in the modern days that because we don't have these stores that were kind of like bastions for cool subversive culture, you kind of just, it gets lost in the ether now.
Right. I mean, we had like big rolling racks full of like gay romance novels that like had been written under pseudonyms. You know, like just all, and it was no photographs. It was all like line drawings of men, like by a lake underneath a full moon in a tank top. Like it was very, like very,
Tom of Finland kind of stuff.
Tom of Finland kind of stuff. But a lot of that, all of John Waters' books and the books of people that had been in John Waters' movies, like Cookie Mueller, like all sorts of like John Waters, everything. Lots of stuff that was all like whatever, if it was about the Velvet Underground or about any of the Beats. My dad was really wanted to create a place like Sea Lights. So he wanted to be a beatnik. And so he wanted a bookstore that would also maybe have events. And so we'd have book signings and things like that. But it was really all sort of thwarted by the AIDS epidemic or the AIDS pandemic, which is our first pandemic, really, unfortunately. But it was a really amazing place when we were there.
Yeah, it seems like it was an amazing time. Like there was this sort of, you know, like just an overflowing of cool things kind of happening, literature from John Waters to like Annie Sprinkle performance art. Like it feels like it was like a real vibrant city to be in at that time.
Really great. Just a great time to be there. And Annie Sprinkle at that point, I think, was living on a houseboat in Sausalito with her wife. So they were like right down the street. There was like so much stuff going on in terms of like punk rock. And there was so much like just starting to happen. And going to shows at like the Night Break and the I-Beam and going to see American Music Club at the Hotel Utah and all sorts of things. I'm really glad I was there for.
Was it weird to suddenly go from this? Because then you, I don't mean to truncate time for it, but like then all of a sudden you're on this incredible national stage, like you're kind of the height of the stand-up comedy world, you know, it seems like shortly thereafter. Was it like a weird thing to kind of go through mentally, or did you feel like you're just rolling with it at the time?
I was just rolling with it. I mean, I didn't really have an awareness of what was going on. I just enjoyed doing stand-up comedy. And it's funny because there were a lot of people who were in music who also loved to kind of be around stand-up comedy. So I would do shows in Hollywood and Maynard from Tool would like come and try to do like sketch comedy. It was like really great. So, I mean, I think that's really cute. It's really cute how like musicians always would get very excited about comedy.
Well, I think because they feel like, well, they're up on stage, they get some laughs in between songs. They also think they can do it as a job.
Yeah, there's just something about it that there's a really huge appeal. And of course, Bob Mould always loves comedy. Bob Mould is like a big comedy fan. So I think it's really fun.
Yeah, there's definitely this synergy, you know, and I think John Worster is one of the funniest people I know and also one of the greatest drummers.
Yeah, John Worster is really actually he's such a polymath. Like he can do everything. Like he's really great at everything he does and truly like Renaissance man to the highest degree. Just a really great, great musician and a really great comedian. And, you know, he's really, really special.
One of my favorite videos is watching you explain Genesis Purge to Jerry Seinfeld, and just
yeah, it's funny because I mean he just didn't really. I mean he doesn't know about Psychic TV.
No,
I love Genesis. She's it's sad because she's like, you know, well now she, you know, she's in perfect union with her love, but I think that she had a lot more music to make.
Yeah, I feel reading her book, it's just been, you know, so eye-opening to how, if there's one person that kind of embodies this sort of punk rock spirit before punk all the way through to today, it was Genesis.
Yeah, she just really, I think, embodied what it meant to be punk rock, and just so genius and just a great, I love the music, you know, all through Psychic Eye, and then like just all her solo stuff, you know, she's just really so phenomenal.
When did you first see Husker Du? You mentioned seeing him in Rock and Reagan, but it seems like Bob Mould's someone that you kind of followed throughout his career.
I saw Sugar probably more times than Husker Du. So I think I saw Husker Du like definitely at Rock Against Reagan, and then during shows at the Vats where they would have those shows at the old beer factory. So he would do shows there with Husker Du. And then later in the 90s, I saw Sugar multiple times throughout like Hollywood during kind of like the workbook through. So the workbook and Sheets of Rain, that kind of era was more just Bob Mould, and then Sugar, which was so many hits and was such a mainstay during like the alt rock kind of 120 minutes era of the 90s, the Matt Pinfield era during the 90s. So I think I just saw Sugar more times than I've seen any other incarnation of Bob Mould.
You saw shows of the Vats. That's so sick. You saw so many
it's so many cool places. And it's like, you know, this is when I really regret that I did so many drugs too, because I really have very, very faint memories of all of it because I was so high and you don't retain all that. And I'm like, you know, I think drugs have a place definitely in the world. But what's sad is that I paid more attention to the drug experience than the experience I was in, because I was actually in the middle of history.
Well, I think that's also just one of the drawbacks of being in punk, is that you get to experience all this stuff so young, including drugs and things like that. So you might not, a lot of times you're not aware of what your limits are or that you need limits even.
Well, it's more like too that you just aren't fully aware of what's happening because you're going to want to remember it, you know, and then you don't realize that you're going to want to remember it because it's just like, why would I care about that? You know, it's just like so cool it's happening, but I'm not going to think about this again. But then you're like, oh yes, I will. I'm going to really treasure this. But so I missed out on a lot of stuff because I was high.
Well, but yeah, like, you know, also it's just amazing how many lives you've led. You know, like from this like weird little punk rock chapter that I'm obsessed with, including this like unbelievable career that goes all these other places. But
yeah, it's great.
Well, yeah. And going back to the Vats, it's like one night of many. Did you ever go to the Gilman?
I'm sure that I went to the Gilman. I mean, I'm sure that I went, and I'm like, why can't I remember? Because I did go to Berkeley all the time. So I'm sure I went, but I can't remember. And I can't remember if I saw people there, who I saw there.
Would you have seen Operation Ivy?
Yeah, I definitely saw Operation. I mean, I'm friends with Tim anyway. And there was like a period of time where I was like, oh, Operation Ivy is the only band. And like, that's, I've told Tim before, like, oh, you know, there's this phase that we go through where we're like, oh, Operation Ivy is the only band. He's like, oh, really? Wow. It's like such a funny thing of like, he's like, yeah, I could see that. Like, he's like, I guess I understand that sometimes you really do go into a thing where I guess maybe it is the only band for some people for some time. It's true. It's
almost like a Velvet Underground type band where everyone that heard it started a band.
Right. It's so seminal is truly like that can be applied there. It's truly the, that that feeling of like people realize, oh, I'm so inspired now. I've got to do this.
Yeah. Like Talib Kweli was on the show and talked about how he used to write Jesse Michaels lyrics on his dorm room wall.
Aww.
And it's like, wow, they had an impact on hip hop too, in a weird way. Like they've had so much of an impact.
Yeah. It's so great. I love that. That's beautiful.
I guess this has been unbelievable. And anytime you want to come back on and talk about punk rock, please know I'd love to talk to you more about this stuff.
Well, thank you.
But before I let you go, can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
For years, Jim Goad has been dining out on this story that he gave the answer, that you gave him you gave Quentin Tarantino the Answer Me anthology, and that's what he based Natural Born Killers on. Is that true?
I don't know if I'm not sure if he based it. I mean, I gave him the Answer Me. I had like bought and given that to so many different people. And I had a bunch of like to a couple comics. I had I gave Quentin a bunch of 8 balls, originally 8 balls. Quentin would come over and we would watch a lot of kind of like exploitation cinema, and then we would read all the stuff that I had gotten from Amok. So it was like a million zines, and a lot of the stuff was like Jim Goad stuff. But I don't know if I couldn't say that he would have based Natural Born Killers, but it if you look at it, it does make sense, you know?
Yeah.
Definitely makes sense.
It's amazing when you think about Answer Me. Like when Sarush was from Vice was on, he talked about how that was like a massive influence on Vice when they started. And it's amazing how that zine, one of the most derided zines during its time, is still has an impact, or still has a place culturally, but has a resonance culturally.
Well, it has a lot of resonance. I mean, I think because I think also like basically true crime and comedy together, that's where it comes from. Like you couldn't have like a Last Podcast on the Left if it weren't for something like Answer Me. Like you can definitely see the cultural like shift of like actually let's bring together a cynical worldview towards all the really terrible things that happen.
Yeah.
And you know, therein is a kind of different way to metabolize tragedy, which I think is really interesting. So that's what I think Answer Me's contribution was. It's like, let's take the sort of moralistic judgment out of all this, and let's just get really like wild with it. And it's a kind of a remix of suffering that I feel is really vital to culture.
Well, I think that's also the genesis of Vice too. Like that was really the Vice sort of viewpoint in the beginning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I love how Vice goes back to like the '90s too, in a way that's really like, you know, it's from the perspective of somebody that survived the '90s as well. So I just watched their Chris Farley, Dark Side of Comedy, which is really, really good. So I think that they just have such I see the trajectory culturally of all these things that we've been through together, and I love it.
I can't wait for the Dark Side of Vice. That's the one we're all waiting for.
Yeah, it's gonna be good.
Oh my gosh,
it's so funny. I love it.
Thank you, Margaret, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Margaret can come back anytime she wants, and we can talk more punk rock, talk comedy, talk movies. She's a legend. Oh my gosh. So grateful I got to do that. Thank you, Tristan. Okay, on to the next episode of the show. And the only way to follow up one legend is with another. On the next episode of Turned Out of Punk, from Blondie, aka Elvis Ramone, Clem Burke will be on the show. And this is a awesome conversation. We talk about a lot of stuff, from power pop records to, oh man, I'm excited for you to hear. I'm not going to ramble on. Why would I spoil it for you now? There's no need to do that. That's it for today's show. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples around the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and different races and different religions and just knock all that stuff off, because we're not talking about politics here. We're talking about just basic human rights shit. And to that, I will also add, we need to make sure, and this is for Canada too, for everywhere around the world, we need to make sure that we do not allow people to take away other people's reproductive rights. We can't let people take away abortion rights from other people, because fuck that. That is fascist bullshit too. And there's no room for that stuff in our world. So get involved in organizations that are doing positive work. Lend your time, lend your money, lend your voice. Just get involved. Speaking of getting involved, get involved in making your own culture. Anyone can do this stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast, start just drawing pictures, making flyers. You know, this gets better when you participate in it, punk. Start a zine. Who knows where that zine could go? Who knows what that zine could influence, as we found out on today's show. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. They could be doing something very positive for someone else. I've seen it. I've seen that do miracles, someone getting a new organ. So sign your cards, please. And I think that's it. Oh, try meditation. If you've never tried it, or you don't believe in it, or you've tried it a couple times, you got frustrated and gave it up. I was there. I felt the exact same way. And then did enough and it kind of clicked. So try it. Who knows where it goes. And that's it. Stay safe. I love you. And I'll see you on the next episode. Thanks for listening.